Yeah, thanks very much, Helen. I've been involved in an experiment in convection which started with the intention of being relevant to some degree to astrophysical problems. However, a few weeks ago there was a meeting on convection here, and I think some of you who were there at that meeting have heard about it in some detail. So I really didn't think that I could take this time to describe that experiment all over again. So I have two related purposes. Even though I said I don't want to take all the time to explain the experiment, I will say a few words about it, because there are some people who are not at the meeting. And then, at the end of the meeting, in fact, it seemed as if I was not there at the meeting myself, so it's new for me, you might say. At the end of the meeting, it was concluded, it appears, that a certain theory due to Grossman and Losa works pretty well for describing the measurements. And so I would mainly spend my time trying to assess its relevance to the problem on hand. But of course, I have to describe the theory to you, introduce it to you, so I'll take a few minutes to introduce it. Although that too was discussed at the meeting, so its first part of it, therefore, will be essentially a rehash of the stuff some of you have heard. So, well, the general thought was that if you look at the convection in the outer part of the sun and make an estimate for the Rayleigh number, which is a thermal expansion coefficient of the gas, temperature difference, acceleration due to gravity. This is the dimension, the vertical dimension of a convection box, let's say, or a convection flow, and viscosity and thermal diffusivity. And the number is of that order. I mean, it's very difficult to make precise estimates for these quantities there, and so it could be off substantially, but that is the rough order of magnitude. In the ocean, for instance, although the oceans are on the whole stable, there are occasions, for instance, in the Mediterranean Ocean, when you have large overturning motions. And if you just take a kilometer as the size of the overturning motion and you say you have a 1 degree temperature difference between the bottom and the top, it's easy to say, see that the Rayleigh number again will be 10 to the power 20. And in these and other situations, the Prandtl number, the other parameter in the problem, which is the ratio of this to that, that varies. It's very small here, of order 10 there, and so on. Now, but the main point of the experiment we started constructing with Niemöller, Lardik Skrbek, and Russ Donnelly, in fact, the construction of the apparatus was done more or less by them, and it will appear next week or this week in Nature. The thought was to try to reach such high Rayleigh numbers to see what might happen to very basic properties of the flow. And our experiment, which is described here, has Rayleigh number varying between a million and 10 to the power 17, which is, doesn't get exactly to 10 to the power 20, but it is getting to be of some relevance. So that is the experiment that I will describe first very briefly. Now, there is almost nothing original about the experiment because the idea was around and it was only a question of making the size larger and building it and making it work and making the measurements. And it uses helium. For those of you who don't worry about helium most of the time, here is a pressure temperature diagram and you have the vapor state, and the hatched region here is the region over which we have varied the flow property, the properties, that's the temperature and pressure, that gives you this enormous range in variation in the Rayleigh number. This closest point does not get close enough to the critical point for us to be worried about the sorts of things that people in critical phenomena worry about. For all purposes in this experiment, helium is a classical fluid. And the apparatus was something like that. So forgetting about all the details, this is the convection cell. And it's a meter in height, half a meter in diameter. You heat here, and you maintain this temperature lower than the temperature of this plate, and you have convective motion that is set up. So, and the measurements you can make depends upon your ability in general with instrumentation. And the simplest one you can make is here, Nusselt versus Rayleigh number. Nusselt number, by the way, again, is the convective heat flux divided by the conductive heat flux that would be possible if you maintain the same temperature difference between the bottom and top plates. So in some sense, it's a measure of the efficiency of convective heat transport by turbulent motion. And over this very large range of Rayleigh numbers, to a first approximation, you can fit a line like that, which gives you a power like 309 with some standard deviation on it, which is relatively small. That's one of the most interesting or most boring set of measurements you can imagine, depending on your point of view. Yeah, well, we will come back to all of that in due course. Yeah. Now, so let me say, without taking you through all the data one at a time, especially because they've been gone through once before, what we have obtained and what we plan to measure, and then maybe invite some comments at the end from the astrophysics type of people, what might be interesting for you to see, and so on. So we have obtained similar data for aspect ratio unity, that was aspect ratio half, and we have temperature fluctuations, both at single point, and we have things like PDFs and spectra and things of that sort. Interesting things there, but nothing spectacular. And then we have multi-point measurements. There were several probes strung together at the same position, some 13 probes or so. And so we can make multi-point correlators, for instance, which would be of interest beyond traditional structure functions and things of that sort. And then we have inferred velocity fluctuations, so I will try to describe a bit later. So we have some statistics on that. Something on mean wind, and then we can make joint statistics between velocity and temperature, which is of interest, let's say, to heat transport people. So, yeah.
This is
circular cylinder, yeah.
Aspect ratio?
That was half the one I showed you, and we have measurement in aspect ratio 1. We will go now to higher and higher aspect ratio. Of course, the Rayleigh number also goes down because the Rayleigh number is based on the height of the apparatus. What we have planned to do, we don't have any profiles of turbulence statistics. That is, we have local measurements. And at the end of this meeting, convection meeting a few weeks ago, I think it became pretty clear that you need more than just a single point type measurement. So we can imagine making measurements of these profiles, which we plan to do. And then one of the things that you might be interested in is we plan to do the rotate the apparatus and get very large Taylor numbers. I mean, you again see Taylor numbers of the order 10 power 20 or so. And we can't quite get there, but we can get to high enough Rayleigh Taylor numbers by putting this apparatus on a rotating table. And that might be of some interest. So with this, I will say no further about the experiment itself, although I will draw upon the data as we go along in making some analysis. And the main point is one of trying to understand the Nusselt-Rayleigh relation that you saw on that plot, or that others in general have obtained before and after. Now you might ask, there may be power loss. In fact, to first order, you saw that in fact on that log-log plot, or a wide range in Rayleigh number, data seemed to plot pretty much in a straight line. Will that power law thing hold if you go a little look at it a bit harder? And if there is power loss indeed, what the exponent might be, Axel already mentioned about 2/7 and 1/3 and all that sort of stuff. And at the end of this, it was it seems to have been apparently concluded that, in fact, the data are best fitted by not by one single power law, but by a superposition of two power laws. This is the Grossman-Losser theory. And there might be other possibilities, which we will briefly discuss.
In that class,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's an important question which I should have talked about myself. But in this plot, up to a Rayleigh number of 10 to the power 13 or so, the Prandtl number was 0.72 or whatever. It was fixed. But beyond that, as you go closer and closer to the critical point, which is really how this larger Rayleigh number was obtained, the Prandtl number started to grow from here around 1 or so to about 25 or so at the very end. So if you take only data below this and fit that by a power law, a least square fit, the exponent is slightly different, but not that it's differs only in a third decimal place. So it's really not a big issue. So as I said, this is my agenda for the rest of the time. Now, one of the things you can, I think, pretty convincingly say, if you still want to keep at power loss, is that the 2/7 and 1/3, which are the classical, more classical and less classical, let us say. Classical means something that nobody really trusts in some sense.
Neoclassical.
Whatever. Now, 1/3, these are Nusselt number compensated by these powers of Rayleigh number. So Nusselt divided by Rayleigh to the power 1/3. And if 1/3 was the power, then it should come out here on a straight line. And if 2/7 were the power, it should similarly do that. And I think it's fairly easy to see that at least over that range of Rayleigh numbers, if a power law were to be used, neither one of them is right. And of course, you can take smaller ranges and decide that maybe 2/7 or 1/3 is right, depending upon your prejudices. And this is what 309 says. Well, as you see, things sort of go down and then go up and go down. This may be a Prandtl number effect. So there are issues there that need to be sorted out.
The laboratory experiments that were done previously, what the
yeah. And now, 1/3 was the classical number. And in fact, there were a number of experiments done in water. I can't remember, but they were around this Rayleigh number, I would think. And they said it's consistent with 1/3, more or less.
They were all less than 1/3.
Yeah, I mean, the force of a good theory was such that people said, well, it's roughly consistent. And then came Albert Lipschaber, and he went up to actually 10 power 14, but he was using only data up to 10 power 12. Their experiments showed 2/7, more or less. And there was theory made on this, as you know, reasonably well.
2/7
is a higher Rayleigh
number and more thinning.
Let's leave it.
For all these figures, yeah.
This is one fixed aspect ratio. One data, one apparatus. One apparatus varies over this entire range. One fixed thing. And in fact, aspect ratio effect is another matter which I will not touch upon. It has some effects which are not very large, but they are there. Now, we actually think that if Albert's data are reanalyzed with the new properties of helium, so to speak, they are not very far from this. But that's debatable in the sense that that is my saying and not what Albert says. So I think I will leave it at that point. Okay? Yeah.
Very simple question. Can you define
yeah.
the Nusselt number?
Yeah, I did mention that, but. I probably wasn't clear enough. So Nusselt number is the heat transport with turbulence in convective, say, convective heat transport, and divided by the conductive heat transport for the same temperature difference. That is same delta T. If the heat transport mechanism were only conductive, the profile would be, temperature profile would be linear, and you know what to expect, and this is what you measure. So that's the ratio. Oh, okay. No, we will get back to this at the very end of my talk. This is my other, I will describe it when everything else fails. I'll get there. Now, of course, as you can imagine, you can make take local slopes of this Nusselt Rayleigh curve, and this was. This was done recently. Now, this is the data. This is averaged over a decade of really. So this is the slope of that curve that you saw in the log-log plot. If, of course, it were one power law, it should have to be, it would be a constant number. There is one thing here which I don't understand, and we will leave that out for this discussion, simply because I can't progress without leaving that out. The data do oscillate a little bit. You might have two attitudes to this. One is, in fact, it's not flat, therefore it's not a power law. And the other is that, in fact, the power law slowly varies. And this point was particularly made clear by the measurements that Gunther Ahlers and his group made here, more accurate than the ones we have now for whatever reason. And he covered the Rayleigh number somewhere below here. And he showed that the slope was actually increasing continually. And the data are very consistent with what we have, by the way. So it's possible that the slope does change. You might say, to first order, the change in slope is not that great. So you might say, well, if you're interested in extrapolating Nusselt number by, say, 4 orders of magnitude, really, you probably won't make a big error in taking it to be a constant slope. But on the other hand, I think it's pretty clear that it's more complicated than a power law with a fixed exponent. I think that much is getting clearer. So we have to think a little bit harder on how to understand this. And the one candidate for this was, as I said, the theory by Grossman and Losa, which I will introduce very briefly. In fact, it's a slide taken from Losa's talk that was given here. And then I will try to see whether what goes into the theory makes sense from a certain perspective or not. So that's the agenda. Now, what did Grossman and Losa do? So this is the box in which convection is occurring. This is maintained at a temperature theta naught plus delta T at the bottom and theta naught at the top. So you have the temperature difference in Rayleigh numbers is large, and so you have convective motion. Now, if the whole thing were conductive, then of course the profile, the temperature profile would be like that. It would go from the bottom to the top, as I already said. Now, if there is convective motion, turbulent convective motion, then the temperature profile sort of looks like this. It's varies very steeply near the wall, and then very little variation in most of it, and the other half of the variation occurs again very close to the top wall, also very sharply. So these are the boundary layers, thermal boundary layers in the apparatus. And this whole scenario is described somewhat picturesquely as a thermal short circuit in the bulk of the flow. So basically, this doesn't take part in terms of establishing gradients for the flow. So now we want to make some get some idea of how thick is the thermal boundary layer. And what you can do is just go to the energy equation, the equation that governs the temperature, and to make order of magnitude estimates. And you simply get that the thickness of this boundary layer is this L, that is the height of the apparatus, as I have indicated there, divided by the Nusselt number. So larger the Nusselt number, smaller the boundary layer becomes in relation to the height of the apparatus. So that's the estimate based on this idea that there's a thermal short circuit in the bulk of the apparatus. And then the idea further is that there is, even though the convective motion is turbulent, it's a high Reynolds number, high Rayleigh number kind of stuff, there is a kind of mean wind, something that goes round and round in some rough sense, and that establishes on the wall a velocity boundary layer, or what they call a kinetic boundary layer. And that has a certain thickness, a lambda u.
Can I ask you about this mean wind?
Yeah.
Do you always have the mean wind, or is yeah. that a thing which is yeah. particularly happening with low aperture ocean?
Yeah. Now, this, of course, is still being debated upon. So let's say this. I will give you some idea of whether there is a mean wind or not in this apparatus at this Rayleigh number. Again, if you change the aspect ratio, change the Rayleigh number, I don't know how it happens, but here is how it is. This is velocity measured as a function of time. It's actually not even velocity directly measured, but inferred by two temperature probes and all that, but never mind. So if you allow me that flexibility, what this says is there is a certain velocity of the order of 8 centimeters per second or so, and it's a negative sign simply because it's a direction that is associated with that. And it suddenly flips over for no reason, apparently, to the other side, also about the same magnitude here. And then it seems to go back and forth like that. And superimposed on that are large fluctuations. So you might say there is a mean wind.
Is there a critical Rayleigh number for the onset of the mean wind?
Well, we know that at 10 to the power 6 it exists, and at 10 to the power, as you go up in Rayleigh number, it seems to become, it seems to make less and less sense, but at least at some level it does exist in this fashion. Now, at 10 to the power 6, by the way, it's all one direction, more or less one direction, and for some reason it seems to flip directions if there is such a thing.
This doesn't necessarily have to be the mean wind across the entire cell. It's just yeah. that one location where the direction of the wind is shifting.
Yeah, around. This is correct. What Bob said is correct, yeah.
This begs the question of trying to describe the mean wind by some sort of secondary instability scenario. And is the threshold for that consistent with the data?
The data on mean wind, direct mean wind, its behavior as a function of Rayleigh number, is really very meager. The idea of mean wind came about from Albert Lipsader's measurements in a fixed aspect ratio cell in water. I mean, he couldn't visualize in helium like it's a cube, yeah.
So really strongly. The whole thing.
There you could see this mean wind, and so this became became an important part of the theoretical thing. Absolutely correct. You are correct. You are right that it was Ruby Krishnamurti who talked about mean wind. Her aspect ratio, however, was large. In this size of apparatus, these guys were the ones who pushed the idea. But you are absolutely correct. I stand corrected on that. So this is the kind of evidence one may imagine having for the mean wind. It's actually not important that if there is such a thing that it flips signs often, but as long as there is such a large-scale circulatory motion like that, you can imagine that a boundary layer does get set up, and you can talk about a boundary layer and then try to make estimates of that, which we will do. What these two guys did was to say that this boundary layer is a laminar Blasius boundary layer. Now, it's a very steep assumption to make, but if you make that, then the thickness of the boundary layer becomes a length divided by the square root of the Reynolds number. As I said, they think it's laminar and they think it's Blasius, which is, of course, a very drastic assumption to have. Then they went on to do the following. Well, they said, well, if you want to talk about the amount of energy dissipated in this entire bulk, in the entire apparatus, you represent it as sum of the two, namely what happens in the boundary layer, like here, and what happens in the bulk. And epsilon theta, that is the amount of thermal energy dissipation, you might say, is similarly split between the bulk and the boundary layer. There is nothing wrong with doing that. And then they estimated these boundary layer and bulk in each case by orders of magnitude analysis. And in particular, let's say, I won't go through all of this stuff because that's really not my purpose. They say in the boundary layer, for instance, it is a viscosity times the gradient of velocity in the boundary layer, which is this mean wind u divided by this boundary layer thickness squared. So it's just estimate of the dissipation. And for the bulk, they said, it follows the Kolmogorov law. That is u cubed by L. So if I have a u there, and L is the apparatus, this is what you might say, something that doesn't depend on viscosity, and so conventionally called a Kolmogorov estimate, although such estimates were around before him. Now, so once you make these estimates, then you can analyze it in the following way. Either the boundary layer contribution is large compared to the bulk, or vice versa is the situation. And if you do one or the other, similarly for this, then you end up with different power loss for the Nusselt Rayleigh number, because epsilon u and epsilon theta, they are all exactly related by the equations of motion by these relations. So this stuff here is equal to this plus that, and if this is large, you ignore that, and so you get the scaling of Nusselt Rayleigh from just the term. And if this is small, you get the scaling of Nusselt Rayleigh from how this scales. And of course, there may be a situation where the two are comparable, and then you don't know exactly what to do. And what they actually said was, the situation is not as if one or the other always really dominates over this range of Rayleigh numbers. So you really have to keep both of them, but different degrees of importance in some way. And that gives rise to this kind of relation, let's say for Prandtl number unity, Nusselt number with one power law here, another power law there, with these coefficients, they just cooked up from experiments. So they said this is how it fits the data. And in fact, what they did was to compare them with the data that I just showed and the Gunter Ahlers data and then a number of others. And for instance, here is one plot, something against something, which should plot a straight line if their theory were right. And as you see, it does plot pretty well on a straight line up to a certain Rayleigh number. This thing here is where the Prandtl number is not constant. So you perhaps should ignore that part. And so they seemed pretty content with this. And Gunther put this to greater severity of test, and he concluded, aside from some Prandtl number effects, which I think is not completely clear yet, this is actually a better fit than anything that is there on the market, so to speak. So yeah.
There really is no Prandtl number dependence according to our measurements, at least not on the Rayleigh number range
yeah.
we covered. And so
yeah.
I really think what you're seeing there, the turnover, is not with the Nesky effects.
There? You mean? No. Yeah, what we have is we have made this estimate of, I don't know if this is an adequate estimate or not, alpha delta t, this number is some measure of how strong the Boussinesq effect is. And in our measurements, this was something less than 0.4, 0.4 at the very, very top. And for most of the things, it was actually less than 0.2. And this is conventionally thought to be enough criterion for non-Boussinesq effect, for Boussinesq approximation to be reasonably correct. So I don't know. You may be right, but I don't know.
That's
at the moment.
That's a fair statement, yeah. Really, for Gunther to be making against that last plot of yours, since that was a plot that was designed for testing the Grossman-Losev theory, and it's not at all clear that the Prandtl number effects in that theory haven't been included in that plot. And as you just said, there's strong reason for questioning whether
okay.
the Prandtl number effects facts are even right. There are other reasons for questioning whether that's at high Rayleigh numbers a non-Boussinesq effect, and I heard yeah. what you had to say on that.
Let me say that I worried about this non-Boussinesq effect, and I convinced myself the following, that if the non-Boussinesq effects were in fact important, then the data which, as you see, show a bend here should actually go that way. So that's how I convinced myself that the non-Boussinesq effects were small. which is something I'm perfectly happy to talk to you about. And I don't know. All I have said is this is how I convinced myself, and perhaps there is a decade of data where Business effects are important, but I have enough decades that I don't have to worry about it for now. So anyhow, then I thought here is where I should move on to my assessment of this stuff. Now, you remember this whole business here is related to the behavior of the boundary layers, the amount of energy dissipated in the boundary layer to bulk and this sort of stuff. And I have, for many, many years, worried about boundary layers and dissipation and things of that sort. So I thought, well, you know, this is something I could say something about, whether this makes sense or doesn't make sense. But of course, I don't know. At the end, I'm not sure. But here is the beginning of it. I convinced myself about what I'm going to say in two different ways. One is making direct estimates of the dissipation in the boundary layer and the bulk, which I will come back to towards the end. And then I set up a simple pedagogical tool to explain to myself how this all may happen. And first, let me give you this simple pedagogical thing. This is supposed to show how dumb one can get, in this case, myself. Now, I'm looking at a channel, flow between two parallel plates, which are held together and held fixed in space, and you push the flow by pressure. And minus one is one wall, and plus one is another wall. And what is plotted here is the gradient of velocity in the flow. Now, this is something everybody seems to know, but as soon as you see this graph, it's startling, at least to me, that over most of the flow, there is no gradient in velocity at all. And all the gradient occurs very close to the wall, and the magnitude here is 146 at the wall. And here, you see, this is hardly anything, at first glance, anyhow. I mean, everybody sort of knew this in some sense, but this is a plain Poisson flaw. Now, so, in fact, if I want to make a model for the velocity for which I am going to do some construction, I would say, well, the velocity here is, on the whole, quite constant. And here, some very simple thing is happening, which I want to fix by some simple way. And I can do it in several different ways. The simplest way is to say, well, it's constant. And here I have some polynomial. And in fact, the difference between a polynomial and a straight line is so small. In fact, the corrections turn out to be of higher order in some small parameter, which is of the order 10 power 4, minus 4 or so in my calculations. So I actually say, let me take it linear for now. So I have a profile which is linear, straight, and linear. And this is my thickness, the thickness of the boundary layer, so to speak, using the language that these guys used. And then this is the bulk. So now I'm going to make estimates of how much energy happens in the boundary layer, how much in the bulk, and see if the assumptions they make are correct or not. Okay. Now, because the profile is so trivially simple, I can actually get at some results. One of them is the mean velocity here is this velocity times a correction factor delta S by R, which is the small parameter in my problem, and higher order terms too if I want. But as I said, this is a very small number already. And then this analog of the Nusselt number, I use S to indicate the sublayer everywhere. Now, this is the pressure drop in the turbulent case divided by the pressure drop in the laminar case for the same mass flow. If you could somehow push the same mass flow through the pipe or through the channel in a laminar state, you would require clearly much less pressure drop. And the ratio between the two is what this number S is. It's exactly like the Nusselt number. It is simply related to the bulk to the boundary layer ratio. So larger this is, larger you have this Nusselt-like number. And then you have this other stuff related to skin friction, which engineers are always going gung-ho about. Then the boundary layer, the average of the energy dissipation in the boundary layer here, which is simply this, nu US squared or delta S squared, because it's a linear profile, trivially so. And in fact, you can show that using this stuff, it is related to nu by u star to the power 4, which is the friction velocity in the boundary layer. And then the bulk energy dissipation, if you say, so far this is nothing is assumed except for this stuff that I said. Now in the bulk, if you say it is Kolmogorov-like, that is the velocity fluctuation to the power 3 divided by the radius there, then this is of the order of the friction velocity divided by r. Then I can make the ratio of the bulk to boundary layer dissipation, and it turns out to be this number here. So it's a kind of Reynolds number based on the friction velocity, the boundary layer thickness, and some correction factor to that.
No,
this is total. These are the averages, but this is not. This is the total. This is stuff that is integrated over the thickness.
Yeah.
Now, see here. This, when I say brackets, that's why I didn't write in symbol. So this kind of stuff is the density, as you said. That is the local dissipation rate per unit mass in the flow. But when I say bulk dissipation to boundary layer dissipation, what I have is epsilon boundary layer times the boundary layer dimension, volume of the boundary layer, and here is the bulk. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So this is not densities, but really the amount of stuff that's happening there.
Because on the Grossman-Lose slide, you actually just summed those things, but you should sum up.
Of course, I should have done that, shouldn't I? On the other hand, I just took their slide. But I know they are doing it right because I went through the whole stuff myself a couple of days ago. So what Charlie is saying is if epsilon u is the rate of dissipation, this is not a correct one. I have to weight it by the volumes. And of course they did it right, but they just didn't use a different symbol or whatever. So anyhow, I've done it right and they've done it right. I can vouch for that. Now I know how to calculate this, and what do I get? I get the following result. This is the inner to outer dissipation to within a constant factor, and for which I have no control. I have Reynolds number here in the pipe flow, and this ratio here. Now I have to say how I obtained this in order to make sense to you, and also I have to ask. I have a certain range of Reynolds number, but remember my interest is convection at the moment. So I have to ask whether I have in fact enough range of Reynolds numbers, and I will conclude something here, and I will also refer to Bob Kerr's simulations and let him speak for himself at that point. So how did I obtain this? How I obtained it is extremely trivial. It's trivial in the following way. Now, I assume the following, which is, I think, very reasonable. I have given a mean velocity. I have given the diameter, or the height of the channel. This you have to be given. I can't work without it. Now, I take this parameter S, this is Nusselt-like parameter, from the experiment. From that I get delta S, from the expression I had shown earlier. From that I get US. So the only thing I am taking from experiment is this. So once I have that, this is in fact that parameter S, which seems to follow something like a nice power law. And then I have this thing here, which is the ratio of the boundary layer thickness to the radius as a function of Reynolds number, which is like that, which has this kind of power. It's not like a sublayer thickness in the boundary layer, by the way, because it falls much more slowly, because sublayer thickness would have a power like unity there. But anyhow, so that's what I did. This is only if you are really worried about how you obtained it. And since I did it all recently, I didn't have the time to fill in all the points. So, but I think it's over this range of Reynolds number at any rate, it's not changing all that much. And what is the Reynolds number range I should be worried about? If you look at the measured Reynolds number in the convection apparatus, this is the Reynolds number. As a function of Rayleigh number, Reynolds number here has that velocity. Remember this velocity, mean wind, that sort of flips around. So that's the velocity. And the height of the apparatus divided by kinematic viscosity. And measurements have been made only up to a Rayleigh number of 10 power 12 or so. Someone was asking earlier, what happens higher? What happens higher, I don't know. I don't know because it becomes very difficult to make the measurements. But if you extrapolated this up to Rayleigh number 10 power 17 or so, which is really the apparatus thing here, so the Reynolds number varies from around a few hundred to about, say, 10 power, this is 10 power 5, 10 power 7 or 6 or some 10 power 7, if you like, whatever. Yeah, I know. I just said that's how much range of Reynolds number I would have. The number that I should have for you, this energy dissipation rate in the inside to out of the bulk, should cover therefore a Reynolds number range from a few hundreds to about 10 power 7 or so, which is what I'm saying I have covered. So essentially, the statement is that for that range of Reynolds number, the amount of dissipation in the boundary layer to the amount of dissipation in the bulk is really about the same. It's the same. This might come as a surprise because the boundary layer is becoming thinner and thinner, but on the other hand, the gradients are becoming sharper and sharper in such a way that, in fact, the two approximately balance each other and give you a dissipation rate which is of the same order. Now, that means you cannot ignore the boundary layer in your calculations if you want to get the right number, even though your Reynolds number might be extraordinarily large. It still will have some thing to say.
Is that a factor 20?
No. This is to within a constant factor, which I don't know. I will come back to the real number in a minute. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is that the energy dissipation in the bulk, it's a small conclusion, as you can see, and the energy dissipation in the bulk is of the same order as the energy dissipation in the boundary layer. The number which Charlie questioned about, I will come back to in a bit. And Bob has simulated that stuff, convection stuff, boundary layers taken into account, although his Rayleigh numbers are not anywhere as high for obvious reasons. He finds that this ratio is about a quarter. That is, the boundary layer to the bulk is about a quarter and doesn't seem to change with Prandtl number at any rate. That's what he told me yesterday. Oh, really? And now, he said he would give me a plot, and now, here it is. Yeah, that's right, yes. Now, since I'm afraid I don't know what the heck he's talking about here, I can't tell you. But this is the distance from the wall. And this is
that's
dissipation rate. You see this sort of goes off like that. So this is somewhere here is the boundary layer.
Right.
And if you calculate the area under there and the area under here, he's saying that the ratio is about a quarter. And in fact, I will come to that number pretty soon. So thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
Now, I said this is a kind of schematic calculation. And of course, I should really, if I'm really serious, I should give you numbers from experiment. And so I should directly...
And the
side wall
and bottom
wall boundary layer? No. This stuff, remember, is all for boundary layers and channels now, this stuff that I just said. Okay? Now, what happens in the convection cell is a little tricky still because of the side walls, as you point out, when the aspect ratio is small. When the aspect ratio gets large, presumably it doesn't matter. Now, the direct evaluation is very hard because you have to measure the energy dissipation close enough to the boundary layer, and that nobody has done, close enough to the boundary. How close? Remember, at very high Reynolds number, this thing becomes skinnier and skinnier, and for a fixed dimension of the apparatus, of course, physically it becomes very difficult. And then You can only make measurements of one velocity and get local isotropy and all that kind of stuff, which you know is completely nonsense near the wall. So there are no measurements on which you can make the direct estimate. And that's the reason I had to go through that exercise that I went through. On the other hand, you can get the energy production very accurately near the wall. This is because it's related to the mean velocity in a pipe and a channel flow. And we know that the production is approximately the same as dissipation in this thing. And therefore, I made this ratio. Well, whether it is an accident or not, I have the numbers. So it's about the same number, which does not change with Reynolds number. By the way, I also did this for a rough wall boundary layer, and I get a slightly different number. But again, the number seems not to depend the number does depend on what flow it is, but it doesn't change with Reynolds number all that much. Now, what does that mean now? This means that if you go back to here, you cannot say that, well, we will ignore this term or we will ignore this term. And in fact, both terms have to be balanced roughly of comparable worth. And you cannot therefore say, well, I'll make an and if they're comparable, they both have to scale the same way roughly. You cannot say, therefore, I'll make an estimate of this in one way and I make estimate of it another way, and then say that the answer is a superposition of two power laws. You really have perhaps one power law, maybe, I don't know. But then, if there is such a thing, you really have to know this thing from somewhere. You have to get it from real hard work, like Charlie Duhring does sometimes. So the point is it's not so straightforward, and you have to work a little harder. And so I don't know. I don't know the final answer. So the thing is a bit harder. So now I come to the question that Grisha was asking very early, well, as logarithm terms. He's always amused by logarithms. So like good theorists, all good theorists are always inspired by logarithms. So say a power law with a logarithmic correction. You know, it's the usual stuff. So. Now I'll go back to here. Now, well, as I said, if you want to sweep things under the rug, you might say you have one kind of power law. Then you have this logarithm stuff. Where is this logarithm coming from? It seems to fit the data as well as this power law does. And remember, the power law has two constants. One is the exponent and the number sitting in front. And here, the only thing that is unknown is the thing sitting in front. So in fact, it is more economical to go with this thing. If only I could be convinced that I have this 3/10 power plus a logarithmic correction. If only I could do that. So how do I do this? I don't know. But let me say what is known. Let me say what is known.
Did you get those numbers by just
fitting? You will see this in a minute. You'll see this. Now, how did it work? There is a good list of people here: Howard, Roberts, Stewartson, Herring, Busse, all the very very respected people who did a weakly nonlinear theory for this problem, for this convection problem. Of course, as Fazle said, in a different context, they were looking at large aspect ratio problem. But what the heck? So we'll do that. And what they define? They find that there is a weakly nonlinear theory just past the onset of convection. And what they found, well, they assumed that all the there is only one wave number for the cells, you might say, that occur in this convection apparatus. And the wavelength of the cell, they decided on the requirement that the heat transport be maximum. Now, of course, I don't know why it should be so, but anyhow, that's what they did. And the answer is this. Nusselt number is 0.24 times this Rayleigh to the power 3/10 plus this logarithmic term. Now, what I have done there is to fudge this factor, which is what you were asking. I fudged this factor, but I didn't change any of this. And the fudging was from 0.24 to 0.059. So there's a factor of 4 or so there. So in fact, what this means is that, well, it could be accidental. Of course, life is full of accidents. In which case, I can ignore and then move on. But it may be meaningful. Who knows? So if that is so, what does that say? It says that the turbulent convection is effectively like it's in the weakly nonlinear state of evolution, except that it has a different transport coefficient because this number is not the same. It's actually off by a factor 4. Now, what that means is that if I can compute a critical Rayleigh number in the flow, the real Rayleigh number in the flow, but with some effective coefficients there, then the magnitude of that number is the same as the critical Rayleigh number in the apparatus. Now, for an infinite aspect ratio, it is 1708. For aspect ratio, which becomes smaller and smaller, the critical Rayleigh number changes a bit. I know that it goes up if the aspect ratio goes down. But nevertheless, it's of that order. So, and in fact, one can spend some time on trying to assess this. And in fact, this idea is not new at all. It's a very familiar concept in classical turbulence, jets and wakes and so on. Townsend, for instance, makes this case very well in his book. Some of you might remember. So now this opens up a new kind of a line of inquiry. You can go further. You can go a little bit further. He actually did rapid distortion type calculations to get at some numbers. This you will see in the second edition of Townsend, not in the first edition. So, in fact, I can do something very similar. Yeah.
Speaking of rapid distortion, how is it that the thermal wind, the generated wind, doesn't find its way into that kind of reasoning? Because you're really looking at the effects of turbulence in the presence of the wind.
Which was the next statement I was making, that in fact I could go, I have gone in that direction in this problem. On a good day I can tell you more about this, but today is a bad day, so I will leave it at that. And then I will make my concluding remark, which is the following. I was writing this before Charlie disturbed me with his talk about cookies, so I didn't finish it. So you are responsible. So what I have said is that we have an experiment where you can go to very high Rayleigh numbers. I don't think you can go much higher in an apparatus that can be constructed in a laboratory. So it might be of interest in a number of ways. And particularly when it is done in conjunction with rotation, it might be quite interesting to some of you, and maybe I would like to hear if that is so. And by the way, if you did the experiment with something like water, you need several tens of meters of the apparatus to get to high Rayleigh numbers like that, and that would be many thousands of tons, and you could clearly not do such a thing as rotation in such a thing. And by the way, the problem with helium is that you can't visualize the flow, but we have developed now over the last year or year and a half methods of making the flow visible by basically trying to find the right sort of particles. It's really nothing very fancy at all. And then, once you have the particles, you can do particle image velocimetry, which, by the way, we have also done in helium now, and although not in this apparatus, but in a grid turbulence. As regards the theory that we talked about, you really have to work harder. I don't think it's easy to say, well, it's one thing here, one thing there, And then it's a superposition of two power laws, although it fits the data reasonably pretty well, actually. I think the final word on this is yet to be spoken. And there are alternatives, as I said, and I don't know how good they are and what one can do. So here I rest my case. Thank you.
What about the physics of liquid helium? Compressible at all, or wave structures existing?
Now, this is a helium one, and so there is no complication about all this second sound and all that. And this is a very highly Navier-Stokes, very incompressible type of flow. Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
Does this this lacks a really to the one third of the law.
Yeah.
Does that suggest perhaps that the heat transport here is really just due to this big circulation roll with a little bit of turbulent dressing on top of it? So really, it may be the heat transport is really just a slightly out of focus, completely nonlinear roll.
I don't know. The one-third comes from a classical analysis where the two boundary layers, as you know, don't talk to each other. So I suppose that is to first order probably right, and then you have a little correction somehow to be made. And the nice thing is to be able to understand what I had in my last but one transparency. If it is more than an accident, then how is it not an accident? I think that will be very nice. In fact, it provides for me a kind of a reasonably profound motivation to do things. Instead of saying it's a superposition of two power laws, which is very nice, but really doesn't tell me too much. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I can't help but follow up on that question.
Yeah.
You know, the suggestion that the weakly nonlinear theory seems to work so well seems kind of miraculous. Except, of course, unless the weakly nonlinear theory is getting the instability that generates the wind right. And if that's really the whole ball game, that might explain why such a simple thing could work.
We all would like simple things to work, as you know. But one has to see why it works. And I respect your points. So we can make a reasonable statement like that. Axel?
You talked about the dissipation in the boundary layer relative to the bulk.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, how is the dissipation between the viscous dissipation and the thermal dissipation, and also what are those dissipation rates relative to the total
yeah. Input? Yeah. Now, I have not talked about thermal dissipation at all in the boundary layers because I'm looking at the isothermal boundary layer for most of what I said. Which is what I know reasonably well. So I was looking at the energy dissipation in isothermal boundary layers. So this is something, again, I have spent some time on. Now, there is a very simple relation you can make, by integrating the equation for the energy. And what it tells is that there is a certain thing called energy thickness, which is just simply a moment of the velocity, which is related to the imbalance between the production and dissipation or something like that. Unfortunately, my model is so simple-minded that I can't push it very high. But the energy dissipation in the bulk is on the whole three-quarters or so. Quarter is what comes from the boundary layers, but quarter is significant enough that you can't ignore it. To me, by the way, this explains some other thing that had always worried me. People who do the calculations, simulations, totally ignoring the boundary layers, also get the Nusselt-Rayleigh number relationship roughly correctly. Of course, the coefficients are wrong, but the power law is the same, and that would be so only if the boundary layer contribution in some sense scale the same way as the bulk contribution. And the numbers are off because, of course, they are not looking at the boundary layer part. So something like that must be true.
But those two numbers are both small, I guess, relative to the total flux input. Is that right?
That's right. That would be small, yeah. Would be small, yeah.
Does that scale the Rayleigh number?
This I don't know. I have to make some
Question. What is the total dissipation in the bulk?
This is small. This is small. I have the number, but yeah. Excuse me.
The total dissipation in the bulk relative to the
is of the order of 0.1% or something like that.
They're exactly equal.
Yeah.
The difference is small, I thought.
Gentlemen, let me answer the question as I understand it. So there is a certain energy associated with the mean wind, and there's a certain amount of energy that is dissipated in the boundary layer. I think Axel was asking the ratio of the two. Was that true? You didn't listen to what I said.
Total dissipation divided by the flux.
Since nobody can explain to me the question.
Is identically Rayleigh number times Nusselt minus 1. I take my calculations. I calculate the dissipation as of over the entire box, and I get exactly.
That's not what he's asking, I think.
I think it is.
It is? Okay. All right. Okay. I'm happy then. I'm happy. Yeah. Bob?
Okay. First of all, I think that the emphasis upon the mean wind is a little too strong. First of all, your data showing the reversal of the velocity, as I explained to you, I mean, I CC'd the email to you, but I talked about it with Joe when he was Joe Nimala. When he was here, the best explanation of that is that there is not a single cell just going around and around and around like this. There actually are two or more cells, and that they're in the cylinder, they're gradually rotating around, and you have this double probe that's your source of your velocity measurements, and you're just flipping from one cell to the other, and that is why the velocity suddenly changes direction.
And
I actually have videos that where you can see this happening over long periods of time in my calculations. Now, the other thing I want to say
is... let me respond to that. It's conceivable that Bob is right. Since we have actually not made the velocity measurements like that, we can't tell. And I think the answer to that is you have to make measurements all through and see whether there's one cell, two cells, whatever. So he may be right, he may be wrong, I don't know.
But the mean wind discussion does not rely on one cell. You can have two cells, same.
You can have, yeah.
On the contrary,
sure.
I think the jury's law for the mean wind is the dominant mechanism.
I don't think,
it doesn't require one cell.
Yeah.
So, second part of your comment.
The second point is something we need to discuss is that if you know the scaling of the velocity in your experiments, and if you make the assumption that the boundary layer near the wall the velocity and the stress of the wall scale with the Reynolds number the way that they would in a classical boundary layer, then you can actually make an estimate of first the stress at the wall and secondly the thickness of the boundary layer. And you put those together and you can actually get a good estimate of the dissipation in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I should show you what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yeah,
and
it's true.
It would be a nice thing to do with your results.
It's all true, yeah. The thing, of course, is it would be nice not to have to put numbers in by hand from somewhere else, but that's a reasonable thing to try first, which is what I tried to do, more or less, but I went about it in what I thought was the simplest way I could understand the problem. Yeah, that's all.
Given that so much really depends on the boundaries, could you maybe elaborate a little bit further of what do you think is now relevant or could be relevant to us for this?
Yeah, well, I think you can look upon my statement or my results, so to speak, in two different ways. One is that the boundary will always retain its importance in some fashion. On the other hand, as far as scaling goes, it doesn't. It really doesn't, which is what Bob was trying to say in the background. Because, after all, why are you laughing, firstly? Well, that's what it was. I was speaking and he was speaking, so it was the background. So, look, the thing is, epsilon, the amount of energy dissipation, is the bulk plus... this is now not the rate, but the total stuff. The boundary layer. Now, if this is always a constant fraction of this, roughly speaking, if I ignore it, the only thing that I will lose out is the number in front. I will lose out the number a little bit. But as far as the scaling goes, it will perfectly scale well, which is why I think all these calculations with ignored boundaries seem to work quite well, which actually makes me happy in a way. It shows I don't have to resolve the boundary layer that much. Yes, sir. And you, Gregory, after that. Yes.
Would it be possible to make an experiment where the heating is extended, so you actually determine the boundary layer yourself? So the heating is not exact at the wall, but it extends a little bit into the medium. That would correspond more to astrophysics. But the other boundary layer is given by other factors such as radiation.
I see. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why I want to do that. I'm not sure why I want to do that, but let's talk about that a bit later. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah. I have a relatively simple question. I mean, I don't think that you showed this in the talk, but if you just, I mean, I thought that one of the points of the Detmer-Loza theory was that most of the experiments are, in fact, in the range where these things almost balance each other, where you're, you know, crossing over in the transition range. So it seemed to be fair to look in the range considered of how much this fraction of the dissipation changes if you just take their fit. So
I could do that. I could do that for you. Yeah, I would easily do that. The point, though, is that, in fact, they think that it is moving over one to the other. I mean, there is one limit in which one dominates the other. And in fact, over a certain range, they say, well, you know, it's you can't ignore one or the other, which is not very different from what I'm saying. But eventually, in fact, one or the other dominates in their theory. And in fact, I don't see that as happening. This is my main point. Yeah.
It would be nice to see the plot.
I showed you a plot, actually, but it was coming from this pedagogical kind of stuff.
Question: what I observed in the simulations is that, contrary to the assumptions of many of the theories, is that around Prandtl number one, all the crossovers have occurred at an extremely low Rayleigh number, around 10 to the fifth. None of these crossovers are of any more importance. So
I think he's right on that. Yeah.
Right. It matters for Prandtl number dependence at lower Rayleigh numbers. But Prandtl number one, it doesn't seem to make any difference at all.
So that's the story, yeah.
Can you say anything about the scaling of the velocity in the turbulence relative to the flux?
You mean the velocity of this mean wind or something like that?
No, the velocity is the turbine velocity.
Oh, no. I don't know. No. At the moment, we don't have any idea. It is a very important piece of information. Yeah. 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 We don't know the answer. Temperature fluctuations we know by measurement. Theta prime by delta T. So theta prime by delta T is something Rayleigh number to the power, something like that. I think that's what it is. I can give you the right formula, but that's hard. No. Rayleigh. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, you can also complain, yeah.
Okay, so the channel thing, be it, or shear layer, whatever.
Yeah. So the,